Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Tonight? It's the afternoon, Justin. I know, we're recording at an odd time.
They don't know that.
They do now. I'm doing fine, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing great. We will see everybody in LA next week. That'll be fun for the meetup. Also, I didn't have the details readily available, but we'll be at Potter and Love, the podcast convention in New Orleans, August 10th through the 12th. So check that out. And CrimeCon coming up too. Use the code GenY when you buy your tickets.
Yeah, you'll save a little on your tickets and you'll let CrimeCon know that you love Generation Y.
Exactly.
Most of you probably have heard of Michelle McNamara by now. I would call her a voice in the true crime field, even though she was more on the writing side, the blogging side. She was married to Patton Oswalt, and unfortunately, she passed away not too long ago. Her passion, though, seemed to be solving cases. And the case that was foremost on her mind was the Irons case, or Golden State Killer. She wanted to solve this case, and in her quest, she was writing her book. Even though she died and she didn't have a chance to finish it, was finished by other people, but it's titled I'll Be Gone in the Dark. And if you haven't gotten it yet and you're a reader, you need to get this book. Everyone that I've heard from, I haven't read it all yet myself, but everyone I've heard from, and from what I know of it, even Stephen King, says that this is a fantastic book. And this is definitely a crime that we all want solved. And this is one more push, one more effort to help solve the case. What do you think, Justin? You think they'll be able to solve this one?
I hope not too much time has passed. I feel that there's a lot of information, a lot of things that they could go back and revisit. But if this guy, this perpetrator's dead, gone, it may not get an answer.
If you'd like to learn more, I know we've covered this case in the past. We titled it Original Night Stalker. So definitely check that out and get Michelle McNamara's book.
It also has an introduction from one of my favorite authors, Gillian Flynn. So I'll definitely be checking it out. So with all that out of the way, what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
This was a difficult episode to title, and it's because there are really three people involved. Ben Smart, Olivia Hope, and Scott Watson. Ben Smart and Olivia Hope, they were friends. They were celebrating New Year's Eve in the Marlboro Sounds at Furneaux Lodge. Early into the morning of January 1st, 1998, they disappeared. The case begins to center on a man by the name of Scott Watson, who didn't have the best reputation and who many believed owned a boat that the couple were dropped off at about 4 a.m. And so our discussion will be about who these people were, the investigation, the trial, and trying to figure out exactly what happened to Ben Smart and Olivia Hope.
There are a lot of avenues and rabbit holes you can go down with this case. We'll try to break it down the best we can on the points that we find important. If it was a clear case of guilt, I don't think we'd be covering it. Nobody would be talking about it to this day. Public debate would not be raging on the internet. So we always like to hear feedback from our fans, but this case is the Stephen Avery of New Zealand. It is the West Memphis 3. It is the largest case out of that country.
In the very early morning hours of New Year's Day, 1998, two friends, Ben Smart and Olivia Hope, boarded the boat of a man they had just met in order to stay the night. Now, they got to this boat via a man by the name of Guy Wallace.
He was a water taxi guy that was transporting people back and forth from the mainland to their boats and to other boats because it's New Year's Eve and there's a big party going on.
They were never seen again after this. So the best place I think to start is to talk about who they were. Olivia Hope was 17 years old in 1998. Her parents were Gerald and Janice. Gerald was a chief executive of the Marlboro Research Center and was involved in politics. Olivia Hope had enrolled at Otago University, where her sister was enrolled. She was working at the Wairoa River Wines in Blenheim, where her mother also worked. At Otago University, she was going to work towards several interests, which included politics, law, and music. She played the piano quite well, from what I understand. Her mother, Janice, said that on December 30th, Olivia had arranged with her to leave work early so that she could get ready for a boat trip she was taking with her sister Amelia and friends in the Marlboro Sounds. And then Olivia was supposed to return back to work on January 2nd, and they expected that she would be home even before that. Ben Smart, his parents were John and Mary Smart from Blenheim. Ben's father was a civil engineer, and Ben was going to join his firm that January. Ben was a musician playing in different bands, and he loved playing guitar, seemed to have one with him everywhere he went.
Scott Watson, his past is a little bit more checkered. As a teenager, he had 48 convictions for different things ranging from possession of a deadly weapon, assault, marijuana charges, drug charges, fighting, just all around great teenager. He did serve two short sentences behind bars. That was back in 89 and 90. We'll get more into his character as we talk about the night of, but I'm sure his family loves him very much. He didn't have a lot of friends. Brother, he had a sister, mom and dad, and he, I don't know, for the lack of a better term, didn't play well with others.
December 30th, 1997, Olivia Hope drove from her parents' house in Grovetown, Marlboro, to Watamanga Bay in Queen Charlotte Sound. Her sister Amelia was there. She boarded a chartered yacht named the Tamarack, along with their friends. The next day, the Tamarack picked up more people in Picton and then traveled to Endeavor Bay. Olivia and her friends went ashore to Furneaux Lodge to celebrate the new year. And while she was there, she met up with her friend, Ben Smart. Ben had been staying nearby in Punga Cove.
So this is a big what to do. There's hundreds of boaters and thousands of people that descend upon this cove, this bay area, and just tie their boats together, anchor up, and party all day long.
Now, because there are so many people partying out there, what you do is you pay in advance. You need to have a place to stay. You need to have your travel arrangements set up because it can get crazy. Now, despite all of that, Olivia had paid for space on the Tamarack, right?
Yeah.
But after they got done partying and they're getting ready to go to the Tamarack, it's full.
Yeah. The beds are filled with drunken, passed out people. There's people partying still on the boat. There's nowhere for them to sleep. And their efforts of, hey, we actually paid to be here, are not taken seriously. And it's late at night, middle of the morning. You know, you've been drinking and partying all night. All you want to do is lay down and go to sleep. And they're not able to do that. So they're going to try to find a place to go sleep. But it's New Year's Eve and or New Year's now. It's not that easy to book a hotel or find at least another party boat that might have an open bed for you.
Yeah, so sometime between 3:30 and 4 in the morning, they're trying to figure out where to go, what to do. Luckily, Guy Wallace was operating a Naiad or a water taxi and offered to take them, at least take them somewhere, right?
Well, they were asking to be taken to the mainland so they can find a hotel. And they're having this conversation, and Guy informs them, like, you're not going to have any luck on the mainland because they've been booked for months. And there happens to be another seagoer on this water taxi, a mysterious man, who says, hey, I have space on my boat. You guys can stay with me.
Well, there's not much choice there, right? There's either take their chances or there's a man there saying, hey, I have room on my boat.
So they initially say, oh, that would be great. But then the man comes back and says, well, only you can come. He can't. And he says this to Olivia. Only the cute blonde teenager can come on my boat, but your boyfriend can't come. That's not creepy at all. No, that's how inviting can you be? Yeah. So really getting off on the wrong foot here, but they take it as a joke. They feel like, oh, he's not being serious. And they still agree to go on his boat with him. And Guy Wallace, the water taxi driver, actually feels that this guy's creepy and this might be a bad idea too, but he lets them do whatever they want.
Well, they're adults, right?
Yeah.
Or at least Ben Smart is. She was just 17, but she was with her friend Ben Smart, and it's really up to them what they want to do.
So this mystery man guides them out to where his boat is parked. And at the time, it's about 100 yards out. So it's going to take them a little bit to get there. Guy Wallace, the taxi driver, will say it's a larger boat and has two masts and it has brass portholes, ornate rope, just a really nice boat. And he even goes so far as to say that he pulls up to the side. It's such a large boat that it's stable and they don't have to go to the other side of the boat to board it. And they also say that they had to step up and climb up. This is a larger seagoing vessel.
But as we said before, Ben Smart, Olivia Hope, they're never seen again.
Yeah, so the last person to see them is Guy Wallace, the water taxi driver, and whoever this mysterious man may have been.
So because the families become concerned, they're not hearing from their loved ones, and especially with Olivia Hope's family, they maintained that their daughter was always in touch, that she always let them know where she was, what she was doing, and when she went silent, it was very much out of character. So what can detectives do but go to the last person known to have interacted with Ben Smart and Olivia Hope? So detectives talk with Guy Wallace, who relays the information as he recalled it, as Justin had laid out before, about dropping them off at this catch. It's a two-masted sailboat.
They also ask others around the bar area and other boaters about this two-masted catch boat that they all seem to have seen that day. And they all give a very similar description. Two masts, so two large sails, just really ornate portholes, a blue stripe down the side of the boat, and ornate roping on the boat. So a pretty expensive boat, I would assume. I haven't priced them out lately, but I think that this thing could range in the $500,000 to $1 million mark.
Guy Wallace, as well as others, have described this mystery man as having been in the bar. He was smoking and drinking. And so the police feel like this must be the suspect. This is the person of interest that we need to find. And then we can go from there and maybe solve this case, figure out what happened to Olivia Hope and Ben Smart.
And there's a few females at the bar that will describe the mystery man. Guy will describe him too, with medium length, disheveled hair and unshaven to the point of almost having a beard. Some of the women at the bar will actually say that he would make passes at them, harass them. He was really creepy.
The man they described as having been around age 25 to 30, medium build, about 70 kilograms, with medium length hair down to the collar, between 5'8 and 5'10. With this information, they start to look for this catch, because as Justin described it, as the witnesses described it, this should be something that's easy to find. It doesn't exactly blend in. But despite a search, and despite having other witnesses describing it, they can't find it, apparently. Since the catch wasn't able to be located, or at least the police never were able to locate such a boat, they started to take a look at a sloop. Now, a sloop is a single-masted sailboat, and people have different sailboats for different reasons. The way I understand it is that a sloop is better for operating in low wind conditions, and a catch is better with stronger winds. Now, I'm sure there are sailors out there that would have a lot more information on this, but these two boats that are being looked at, the sloop and then the catch, there's also a size difference. This sloop was about 14 to 16 feet shorter than the catch that was described.
So the catch is 40 to 45 feet long, and the sloop is around 25 feet long.
But this sloop is owned by a man by the name of Scott Watson, who we spoke of earlier.
Scott has short hair, and from a photo taken of him, he looks fairly groomed or clean shaven. So not the description of this mystery man that you'll find all kinds of artist renditions out there on the interwebs.
On January 12th, the police really started focusing on a sloop that they had located, and it was moored near private property in Erie Bay around 11 a.m. on New Year's Day. They took it in and found that it had been recently repainted. It had been white and red, and then was later repainted blue around New Year's Day. So this right there is already suspicious, right? They're looking at this sloop. They suspect that it might be the boat. Now, why they think a catch and a sloop could be mistaken is anyone's guess. But this is what they're looking at. The only thing I can say at this point is, on New Year's Eve, a lot of people are drinking a lot of alcohol. And who knows? I mean, if you drink enough, you can make mistakes, right, Justin?
Yeah. But technically, these are two totally different boats. You're kind of looking at the difference between a restored 1960s Chevy and then maybe a Pinto. But they're both nice boats. I mean, anyone that is a boater knows that boats are expensive. And Scott Watson built his own, probably because he couldn't afford to buy one.
The police are continuing to take statements from people, from witnesses. On this boat, they're finding what they think might be some evidence. They're not finding blood evidence, but they're finding hairs, and they also have identified some scratches on a hatch. And so now they have to go back to Olivia Hope's family and Ben Smart's families, and they're going to collect samples, hair samples, or even blood samples from parents, just so they have something to compare evidence to. And so you can imagine at this point, the families are probably pretty worried that these two, Hope and Smart, have met with foul play.
The scratch marks are on the underside of the hatch. It's the only opening leading into the inside of the sloop, I guess the berth. It's the only way in and out. And the bottom of the hatch is foam. So if somebody were to scratch at it, it leaves those impressions. And this is giving the idea that whoever was locked into this boat was scratching their way out.
Which paints a very frightening picture. A lot of people have it in their heads that Olivia was locked down there and that she couldn't get out, so she was scratching desperately at this hatch. But a review of this hatch reveals that the scratches go beyond, they go to the edge of the hatch, which means there's no way that they were made when the hatch was closed because then they wouldn't have reached the edges. Scott Watson's sister said that some relatives, some children, actually scratched at it. And furthermore, there was no way to actually lock the hatch. Now, I noticed right away that it doesn't really matter if there's a lock on something. You could close the hatch and sit on it, and it would be very difficult for someone to get out.
Exactly. There's ways to seal a hatch because he has to batten it down when there's a big storm. He would use a rope or something like that. The scratch marks would have been covered up or obscured if the hatch was closed, and whoever's scratching at it is able to get to these inaccessible places, and it's not exactly as eerie or creepy once you understand that.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
They kept this boat, this sloop, for about 10 weeks. They removed the hatch and replaced it with another one so that they could have the hatch as evidence. They took a blanket from the boat. It had contained over 400 hairs.
It's the infamous tiger blanket because it has a woven tiger face on it.
And also, we need to talk about the painting of this boat because Scott Watson's boat, his sloop, did not match the description of this catch at all. So you could say, well, maybe they got the size wrong. They could have got some other details wrong because it was dark and people were drunk. So that's understandable, but how do you get a red and white boat mixed up with a white and blue boat?
You really don't. And all the witnesses that claim they saw this boat from before New Year's to even after New Year's give very similar descriptions of this two-masted catch. Ted Walsh, he was a charter operator. It was 9 p.m. before it got dark. He describes it. Susan McCracken at 1 p.m. December 31st, early afternoon. She describes it. David and Nancy McNoll, late afternoon. They give descriptions of this boat. Harold Saunders on New Year's Day, early morning. He describes it. There's multiple witness statements about this boat. I have like 15 more, but I'm not going to read through them all because all of these people saw this really nice two-masted kitch with a blue stripe down the side. And I believe that they actually saw this boat.
And even after the sloop was known to have been painted, it wasn't a blue stripe. I mean, it wasn't painted that way at all. So it is odd that it went from being white and red to part of it being painted blue.
And what kind of idiot would paint his boat blue after that's what the cops are looking for. I mean, hey, you know, a blue Mustang just robbed this liquor store and you're driving a red Camaro and then you're going to paint your Camaro blue. Like, nobody's going to do that.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. The police were putting out information. They were hoping for the public to come forward and for a break in the case. They had between 1,500 and 2,000 people who had statements to make. It takes a long time to get statements from each of these people and to collate that information so that it's useful in your investigation.
They were also leaking information to the media. When they pulled Scott's sloop out of the water, there was a whole media circus there waiting to film them doing it. And this was supposed to be all on the down low. No one was supposed to know who the suspect was, but they were there. Normally the media is there because somebody let them know that this was about to happen.
With any case, when you have a suspect, that suspect becomes the center of the case, and oftentimes the victims are forgotten about. And in this one, Ben Smart, Olivia Hope, their families were out there talking to the media and reminding people that they were looking for them and that they hoped to find them alive. As the investigation goes on, as time passes, things start to look pretty grim, but it really felt like they never really stopped getting that information out to people. Hey, there were victims here. You might say they've just disappeared, so we don't know that they met with foul play necessarily, but given their past histories, their families knew them quite well. The fact that they were missing, after a while, it really does look like they were murdered.
Cops will question Scott and his family members. They will inform his family that Scott's the prime suspect and we know he did it. They will divide the family members up and start giving them different information. They'll even go to the neighbors of Scott Watson's family and start informing them, oh, by the way, that guy that lives over there, he's the prime suspect and he probably murdered this couple. They search their homes and their places of work. And this is his sister. This is his parents. And they're doing raids on their workplace. Now they're getting threatened with being terminated from their jobs and stuff because their employers are like, you're under investigation for a murder, so I don't really want you working here anymore. It's pretty aggressive police tactics that they're using against the Watson family. So obviously Watson's family feels like the police are trying to divide them, trying to get them to go at each other. They're not appreciating the accusations before there's a trial. They're coming in and searching the parents' home at weird hours, you know, and then they'd come back and search again. Now, in any murder investigation, you do this. You get a search warrant, you go to a property, and you're looking for anything that you can tie back to this case. But the family thinks that they're just being harassed. They're doing it to divide them. They informed Scott's sister that she was covering for her brother and that she was probably going to end up in jail for doing this. And they threatened to take her children away.
Well, doesn't it start to feel like there's something against this family, right?
Well, yeah, that's how they play it. And the Watson family is speaking out just as much as Ben and Olivia's family and talking about these police aggressions against them. Also, all of the witnesses who saw this two-masted catch and were describing this ornate, beautiful ship, they're following up with the police, and the police are saying, yeah, I don't think you saw that boat. That boat doesn't exist. We've scoured everywhere. We can't find that boat. And we've looked at photographs of the event, and it's not showing up in any of the photographs. Now, this was the late 90s, so everybody doesn't have their cell phones with Facebook and Snapchat going to town. This would be regular cameras, and there's no social media. So I don't know how far-fetched it is that you wouldn't find the boat you're looking for in any photos or from any witnesses. But the fact that the police are telling these witnesses, you didn't see what you saw, this puts a lot of people off. They're not gelling with this idea that they made this boat up and it doesn't exist. So a lot of them feel very put off by law enforcement, and they know what they saw, and they're going to double down on that now and say that law enforcement is utterly wrong in their determination that this boat didn't exist.
Right. You have people who are around sailboats all the time. They know everything about sailboats, and now they have the police telling them, you don't know what you're looking at. I don't know how everyone else is, but I can literally drive down the road and I can catch a car going by at a glance. And usually I know the make and sometimes the model of it just right away, just by looking at it, just briefly. And I imagine there are a lot of people there who, as they described, are being honest because they're saying, I saw this catch. It was really nice. So I looked at it, right? It really caught their eye. Just like you'll see a car go by and you'll think, oh, well, that's just a Ford Taurus. But if you saw a Dodge Viper go by, you might look at it a little longer because it's kind of unique.
Starts making this case somewhat questionable is the police dictating the narrative and the witnesses being told, you don't know what you're talking about. Meanwhile, the police are showing photographic lineups to people at the bar, to Guy Wallace. And these lineups have six guys, you know, all photographed in there. And every single one of them has a photo of Scott Watson. And at no point do any of these witnesses pick him out during the initial questioning. And it's not until they find a photo of Scott who is in a half blink. So his eyes look like they're a little, like he's tired or kind of sneering at the camera, that somebody says, well, those eyes actually look right. Well, photo's a little bit off because it's not what Scott normally looks like with his eyes wide open. It's him with his eyes half closed, kind of looking sleepy, which aligns up with the artist's rendition of this mystery man. So at that point, one of the witnesses is like, hey, that looks like him. The eyes look like him. And the police, of course, circle it and say, autograph that, you know, put your signature next to it because you've just identified him. And even the people that are identifying it are like, I'm not sure that's the guy. I'm just saying that those eyes are the closest.
But for the police, this is a huge lead, right?
Yeah. Well, it's the guy that they've already targeted. And now they finally got somebody to say, hey, that looks like him. After multiple attempts of showing this guy in photo lineups to all these witnesses. Well, after a while, when you see a face over and over again, it might start looking familiar.
The police are pretty certain that Scott Watson is responsible for whatever happened to this couple. And in April of 1998, they arrest Scott Watson for the theft of an aluminum dinghy. From there, even though it's not apparent at first, we discover that that's just to get him locked up. They're actually planning to charge him, which they do. In June of 1998, they arrest him for the murders of Ben Smart and Olivia Hope. They seize his sloop, Blade, again. So they have Scott Watson, they have his sloop, and now they're really going to work on this. They're going to get him set up for trial, right, Justin?
Yeah, they have to establish the timeline for the night. They have to put him there with Ben and Olivia. They have to show that Ben and Olivia have not shown back up. They have disappeared. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that they've most likely been murdered. And this is the last person to have been seen with them. So connect the dots. And then they have evidence from his sloop that's going to prove that Ben and Olivia were on this man's boat and he was the last person to see them alive.
Since there were over 1,500 people in the Marlboro Sounds at the time, it took them a lot of work to try and establish timelines to figure out who would have been left to be in that position to be on a water taxi with Ben and Olivia. As best as the police can tell, the only person who could have been on that water taxi with them at the time was Scott Watson.
Scott Watson will say that he actually returned to his boat, the Blade, at around 2 a.m., but he's really loose with the times because he doesn't really remember that well from the night.
He doesn't have a watch, and I can understand that because I used to wear a watch to work, but I wouldn't wear the watch anywhere else because I wasn't on someone else's time when I was not at work.
So his memory of the night's a little shifty, but we do know that people did see him at some of the bars, and there was a altercation in the morning that he was involved with some other guys, and that happened closer to 3:30. So even if he had gone back to his boat at some point, it was obvious that he had returned back to the mainland into a bar by 3 a.m. There isn't just water taxis that are toting people around. People have their own little dinghies, their rafts, and they can get rides with other people. So people are coming and going all the time. This must have been madness to try to figure out a timeline for the police. And I know that sometimes the investigators and the prosecution will assume things because they're basing it on 100 different witness testimonies. And it's not going to gel correctly. And then you have Scott, who's not giving a basic alibi on his whereabouts. So it's really messy, but let's try to go through it on what happened that night.
The trial of Scott Watson takes place about a year after his arrest. We're not going to go through the whole trial. We're going to go through the evidence, but just know that when he was on trial, the witnesses who gave statements to the police, when they were at trial, their statements changed some. Again, it was New Year's Eve. People were drinking. Time has gone by. It's been about a year and a half since whatever happened. And yet the prosecution is successful and they get a conviction of Scott Watson, who maintains that they got it wrong. But we're going to go through the evidence because, again, it's about establishing timelines. Even at trial, the prosecution stated that the most important thing to establish in this case, since they did not have bodies, they were not able to find Ben Smart and Olivia Hope, the most important aspect of the case was, who was this mystery man? Who was on that water taxi? Who was the person that was last seen with the couple?
And you can already tell that the descriptions of the mystery man are not syncing up with Scott Watson. Scott Watson had short hair. Scott Watson was allegedly clean shaven, whereas these descriptions and even the artist renditions, you'll see pretty much what looks like a meth head, some guy with crazy wild hair and a full beard. And then you look at the picture of Scott and you're like, no, that's not it. Meanwhile, you're hearing about his boat, which is 20 to 25 foot and red, one mast. It does not sync up with the 15 plus witnesses that are talking about this two-masted catch that is ornate, beautiful, and has portholes on the side. So this is causing a lot of issues, at least in the public eye, on the viability of Scott being the prime suspect. But they get their evidence. They have the scratch marks on the inside of the hatch. And then they find two hairs on that tiger blanket that are blonde. And most of the hairs that were recovered were all brown. Obviously, Olivia was a blonde. So for them to find these two hairs is a big deal. And they do their tests on the hairs, and it comes up as, I think it's like 28,000 to one that it's somebody else besides Olivia. But even if these are Olivia's hairs, there are problems with the way that they were collected, the way that they were analyzed. When they went through the blanket and the boat, they just dumped all the hairs they could find into two plastic bags. And then they would dump these bags out on a table and sort through them and slowly, under a microscope, look at the hairs and determine which ones would be Ben or Olivia. But that's a lot of minute detail to go through. Also, they had gone to Ben and Olivia's homes and got samples of their hair, got samples from their families. And these samples are on the same table as the hairs that they've collected from this boat. And then you find out that one of the bags of Olivia's hair that they'd pulled from her home had a slit in it, a cut in the bag. Well, people don't like this. They assume that Olivia's hair could have fallen out of this bag, mixed in, or just simply you had a mix up of, well, which hair came out of which bag do we know? I mean, how do you label and tag a tiny little hair? It would be easy to mix this up. It's really called into question this smoking gun evidence of two blonde hairs that somehow were missed for weeks when they were analyzing the hairs. And people are like, well, hey, wait a second. Scott Watson has short brown hair. Olivia has long blonde hair. How do you not see a long blonde hair in these bags for weeks? And then all of a sudden you find them right before trial.
I have some problems with this. You can't label every hair, but why couldn't you count them? I mean, it wasn't until the third analysis by the woman that was doing this where she found those two hairs. I don't get why they couldn't count them, so that if they had started with 436 hairs, say, and now they have 438 in this bag, now you know that's really suspicious. But they didn't do it that way. And during trial, this was something that the defense really tried to attack by saying, you already looked through these two bags of evidence twice and didn't find any blonde hairs. And then all of a sudden, on the third try, you find them, but then you also find that there is a cut in the bag that's holding the hair evidence of Olivia Hope from her house. So that's a real problem. I've seen it argued that a cut in a bag like that doesn't guarantee the hairs would fall out. But guess what? I don't care. That doesn't mean anything to me. Now, if you have doubt on this evidence like that, it's not fair to err on the side of not caution here.
Yeah.
You know, oh, we're just going to say, well, yeah, they could have fallen out, but there's no proof they did. You already had two prior goes at those two bags of evidence and no blonde hairs were found. And now you're going to tell me that even with that cut, you're going to go forward and say, yeah, we found her hairs on his tiger blanket. That doesn't work for me.
Also, I saw a whole forum where people were talking about the hairs not even being Olivia's. They're like, oh, 28,000 to one. Well, that pretty much means that it's a 45% chance. They're like, haven't you ever gambled before? This isn't a perfect match. And with the questionable bag cut and just accusations of them wanting to go after Scott, they had their Scott goggles on from day one to nail this guy. How hard would it be to plant the evidence? How hard would it be to just say these are a match?
Well, they talked to the analyst about that, and she said that the bags would be sealed and the only way to open them was to cut them with scissors, and she would have to sign the evidence in and out, and hers was the only signature ever found when these bags were signed out. She didn't have an explanation other than once in a while you can accidentally cut the inner bag. So again, I just say this is evidence you can't really use, in my opinion, but it may have had an effect on the jury.
The defense team is doing their best to poke holes in the bags. And this is what they got. They show that the hatch could have been scratched by the children way before this night. There's no way to timestamp the scratches, but the prosecution will absolutely use these scratches and the photographs to give the jury a very grim picture of a teen girl trying to escape a boat.
Now, Scott Watson's sister, who had helped clean his boat because it had a lot of salt water all over it, said that when she gave her statement to police, she described the incident where the scratches happened, and that it happened in December. She said that the police were made well aware of this, but they went ahead and tried to describe it as scratches that must have happened when Olivia Hope was trapped in the boat. So, I mean, just between the hairs and the scratches, and then the questions about whether it was a catch or a sloop, you can see why the public in New Zealand has a lot of problems with this case against Scott Watson.
Absolutely. The prosecution during the case, or during closing arguments, will talk about the two-trip theory. And this is Scott and his defense saying he returned to his boat at around 2 a.m. So therefore, he wasn't around when Guy Wallace took Ben and Olivia out to this mystery man's boat at around 4 a.m. So this is a problem, but the prosecutors are like, well, he came back to shore because he had this altercation with these guys. One of them was named Ollie, and Ollie was wearing his sister's necklace because his sister happened to be dying of cancer. And so Ollie was wearing this necklace in sort of honor of his sister. She gave him the necklace. Well, Scott Watson says that he's returned to his boat at around 2 a.m., but he's not sure about the time. And it was an old guy wearing a hat. Well, there wasn't an old guy wearing a hat that night. There was a couple other taxi drivers that were older, but none of them were wearing a hat. The prosecution says it's inconsequential because we know that he was on the mainland because of this altercation at around 3 a.m. with Ollie and his friends. And that altercation was Scott trying to demasculate Ollie about wearing a feminine necklace.
Yeah, it was around 3 a.m. that Scott Watson walked into the main bar at Fernal Lodge. And according to Oliver Perkins, he noticed that Watson walked in by himself. Oliver Perkins had been hanging out with some of his friends, Mark Tapley, Millie Seville, and Amanda Egdon. And he said when Scott walked up to him, he identified himself as Scott from Wellington, and that Scott appeared to have had a number of drinks by then. This is when that, I guess, heated conversation started up because Scott's looking at Oliver and thinking, that's a woman's necklace. Why are you wearing this woman's necklace? Are you a girl? And Perkins responded that he was wearing it because it belonged to his sister who had cancer. And Watson replied rudely, yelling that she only had 2 years of life left.
She'll be dead in 2 years.
I mean, that's horrible. A friend of Perkins, Chris Bisman, was watching this happen, and he came over after Oliver walked away. And by this time, Scott Watson had sat down at this table with Perkins' friends, and he just confronted him about it and said, dude, that's not cool. You know, why are you talking to him that way? That's his sister, and she's got cancer. And he said that Scott responded that he was right. And when Oliver came back to the table, he apologized to him. Now, Amanda Egdon, who was also at the table, had run into Scott Watson about 2:45 in the morning. So this was just 20, 30 minutes before. And she said that he was talking about inviting her onto his double-masted catch, which I find interesting because he had a single-masted sloop. But he told her about his double-masted catch. Oliver Perkins would also say that in his conversation with Scott, that Scott would bring up a double-masted catch. So I find this very, very strange. Amanda would also say that because he was inviting her onto it, she was talking about helping him man the sails, and he let her know that he wanted a different kind of help from her.
Some of the women at the bar will actually say that he would make passes at them, harass them. He was really creepy. What a guy.
So he's trying to get women onto his boat for sex. That's what it comes down to. And throughout the night, as Justin had said earlier, he was very forthcoming about that and being rude, sexually harassing women, and he even groped one woman's chest. So very, very suspicious behavior. But I'm still left wondering, why is he mentioning a double-masted catch to people?
Well, obviously, he doesn't own one. And if they did actually come out to his boat, they would see that he was full of it. He just had an altercation with both Ollie and this other female. And then they find out that he's possibly a suspect in this terrible crime. Well, maybe they're making it up because they don't like him as a person. So they're like, yeah, he said he had a two-masted catch. It's a possibility.
Yeah, I'm just left wondering about it because I haven't really seen anybody debating this point about what Oliver Perkins and Amanda Egdon had said, but it really stood out to me.
And maybe he actually said it too. I'm not trying to totally debunk the witness testimony there.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
There are lots of claims and alternative theories from mysterious drug syndicates to Ben and Olivia falling overboard. So those things are thrown out there because of the doubt over Scott Watson. And when you try a murder case without bodies, you got to really have a lot of evidence and a lot of things that pin this guy down. And unlike the Carrie Culberson case where we covered her disappearance, where her boyfriend was highly aggressive and abusive towards her and was the last person seen with her, we don't have all these things in this case, do we?
Yeah, the question about whether Scott Watson is truly guilty or not, that just persists even to this day. And the trial hasn't done anything to stop that. Obviously, he was convicted. But again, people say, well, wait a minute. There was a catch scene. The catch was too nice. It stood out. And if you have the NIAID driver, Guy Wallace, saying, yeah, I dropped them off at a two-masted catch, then why is there a debate here? How can you, even if you were to say that was Scott Watson, I mean, it's the wrong boat, right? They took a sloop into evidence. They never found a catch. So right there, they have a problem. They have the wrong boat, right? Then if you take the photograph that was taken of Scott Watson that night, December 31st, 1997, it doesn't match up with the identikits that were created from witness testimony, people that saw this mysterious man drinking at the bars at Fernone Lodge. So now we have a misidentification problem. Then we further have Scott Watson saying, I wasn't even there. I went back to my boat, the Blade, which is a sloop. I did not kill these people. And then you add in the hair evidence that's really, really, really flimsy. I know people have said there's no guarantee those hairs ever came out of that slit in the bag. But honestly, after looking through all of the hairs twice, and these hairs are dark, and then they're looking for blonde hairs, and then they just happen to find them the third time, and they verify there's a slit in the bag from the scissors, come on.
Oh, and then there's one more thing that we didn't mention about that is they weren't even really looking for Ben's hairs. And I wonder why. I actually thought about this when I was reading, and I was like, well, Olivia, that's more sympathetic to a jury, a young female being murdered. Yeah, you're going to attach to that a little bit more emotionally, whereas some guy getting murdered, well, no one cares. It's kind of a crappy thing, but things the prosecutor and investigators will do is they will leverage emotion against the suspects in this way.
Well, that's definitely possible. I wouldn't put it past them. But on the other hand, Ben Smart and Scott Watson, perhaps their hair color just was too similar, and it would make that identification more difficult. Remember, the only way you can DNA test hair is if it has the root attached. And I don't know, maybe they just didn't have any roots to check on these. So they don't have hair evidence, right? That infamous tiger blanket, how useful is that? We talked about the painting of the boat. Why would a person suspected of murder paint their boat the same color as another boat? And then beyond that, when the boats are so dissimilar, because one's a sloop and one's a catch and one had a stripe and one just has part of it painted blue now, there just really isn't anything there.
The officers really emphasized that the boat was wiped down or cleaned thoroughly as if to cover up a murder. But it's a boat. You get salt water everywhere. It's corrosive. You have to clean your boat. You have to upkeep it. So is it really that odd that he wiped everything down?
Yeah, and there's a lot made about that the boat was actually wiped down, but it was only 30% of the surface. I mean, that could be argued the other way. You could say, well, only the 30% of the surface that was wiped down because that's where the evidence was.
Yeah.
But really, I don't see much to do with that either, because we're still talking about the difference between a sloop and a catch. People do clean their boats. I don't really see this as something important, and I don't see anything that points to his guilt regarding this, about the wiping down of the boat. It sounds suspicious, and you can definitely write an article and make it sound damning. But if we're going to be objective about this, I don't think you can point to it and say, yeah, he must be the killer. So in the end, what do they really have against Scott Watson? I know they got a conviction, but they don't have bodies, and they can't get a witness to say that was him. That was Scott Watson that was in the water taxi with Ben and Olivia and Guy Wallace.
Yeah. And this is the part of the podcast where anyone that's familiar with this case who absolutely thinks Scott Watson is innocent has been applauding us. And it's the same part of the podcast where anyone that thinks he's fully guilty is going to like everything else I'm about to say, because I actually think the guy totally did it. And I have my reasons. You're like, what? But you guys just destroyed all the evidence. Not really.
When you're talking about evidence and you're making a comparison, just we'll take the sloop and the catch, for instance. When you say, look, if everyone saw a catch and it was much larger, you know, about 15 feet longer and had two masts instead of one, different colors, then how can you say that there's evidence against this guy when the police have totally gone off the script here? You know, they didn't go with what the witnesses were saying. How could they get that wrong? Well, if you start off with a false premise, everything that happens after that is tainted.
Absolutely. Pretty much from the start, I went into this not being part of a narrative, not really caring if this guy was innocent or guilty. I just wanted to know what happened that night.
You probably didn't even know about this case before we put it on the schedule, right?
Sadly, I've only heard of it by name, and I had no real clue of what the details were. I just want to emphasize that very unbiased here. I just want to get to the truth. So the mystery man sketch that was drawn up, when I looked at that sketch myself, the hair does not match. But when I look at the eyes, when I look at the nose, when I look at the mouth, I think they're dead on for Scott. So I think the artist's rendition isn't that far off. Just they got the hair wrong. And when I say the hair, I mean the hair on his head and the hair on his face. And I think this is a bad interpretation of all the witnesses saying, oh, he had disheveled hair and he had a beard or facial hair. Well, you can have disheveled hair with short hair. And if he's out there drinking all night and getting into fights or trying to, well, his hair can get messed up. That's normal.
An identikit or a sketch is based on witness testimony. These are people that are drinking, and I hate to say that they're not going to know exactly what they're talking about, but little details like this matter. Is the hair 3 inches long, 5 inches long, half an inch? I mean, it will matter. And there were witness statements taken at the time that they were originally interviewed that much more closely matched Scott Watson than what was later revealed in court. Furthermore, the picture taken of Scott Watson is rather grainy. So picking up whether he had some stubble or not could be rather difficult. So we're going off of people's memories versus their statements versus reality. And getting those things to line up can be rather difficult.
And it's said that when Ben and Olivia asked the mystery man if they could sleep on his boat, his response was, "She can, you can't." Well, going off his behavior all night towards women, I think that fits his personality pretty well.
He was only asking women to get on his boat up until, if you believe he was there, he asked Ben and Olivia to get on his boat. And remember, the person joked, just like Justin said, hey, only she's allowed on. So, yeah, it really does fit.
He says that he went back to his boat at some point in the night, and he says 2 a.m. We know that he went back to his boat that night because he changed his shirt, groomed himself a little bit, maybe combed his hair, which, oh, he combed his hair? Well, why did he comb it? Probably because it was disheveled and messy, right?
Yeah, his hair that night was actually down close to his collar, so there was enough to brush. And he did show up in a different shirt that night.
Now, there was a water taxi that took him back to his boat, and that witness wasn't sure about the time either, but he said that the boat was facing out, which the tide comes in and tide comes out. Well, the tide was coming in before midnight, and this taxi driver said, Scott was the only one waiting for me. There was nobody else. So it was just me and him, and I took him to this location where his boat was. Now, this is important for a lot of different reasons. One, it places the time before midnight for the tide coming in and the boat will face towards the tide. And second, there was nobody else on the boat because everybody else is waiting for that countdown at midnight. So nobody else is going to just go back to their boat by themselves at this point. Everyone's digging in for the big hurrah. So it does make sense that this was before midnight that Scott went back to his boat to change his shirt and brush his hair. And it wasn't at 2 a.m.
Yeah. And he is seen again sometime after midnight at Furneaux Lodge. I had already talked about Amanda Egdon talking with him at 2:45 in the morning. And then, of course, he had his altercation with Oliver Perkins. And the Perkins situation is really, really important to this case because every time you read about what Scott said happened that night, he said, around 2 o'clock, I went back to my boat. How is that possible if he had this heated discussion with Oliver Perkins between 3 and 3:30 in the morning? Now, remember, Scott, by his own admission, says, I don't wear a watch. I don't know the exact times. I'm just telling you what happened the way I see it.
Well, and then if we assume that he went back to his boat before midnight and then came back to the mainland, well, none of the taxi drivers are like, oh, yeah, I'm the one that brought him back. Well, they're carting people around all night. And at around 2 or 3 a.m., that's prime time for the taxi drivers because at that point, everyone's sort of done partying and going back to their boat. So they're going to have full loads. And this isn't even to say that Scott didn't get back to the mainland hitching a ride with some other boater or partygoer on their personal vessel.
But Scott doesn't say that, does he?
No, he doesn't. So I shouldn't even speculate on this because all he says is that he left and went back to his boat and he used a water taxi of an old guy wearing a hat. That's his own words. His words are not, I did this, I did that, and I got on a dinghy and da 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 da. He admits that he got into this altercation with Oliver. That's part of his narrative. Well, now we place him back on the mainland after 4 a.m.
One thing they can track is exactly who was operating a water taxi that night and into that morning.
And the times they were operating.
They know that after 3:30 in the morning, there were only two water taxis operating at that point in time.
And that was Guy Wallace and the son of the owner of the water taxi company. So this taxi service is the only one operating in this area. And the son of the owner is very adamant that he did not take Scott Watson anywhere that night, especially after 3:30, 4 a.m. in the morning, because he was winding down. So then we're back to Guy Wallace. And Guy Wallace made one more trip out, the full load, taking people back to their boats. And Guy Wallace is the one that gave the initial description of the mystery man on that boat. And he gave the description of this two-masted ketch that everyone's talking about. But this is early in the morning. This is the night's winding down. So the only witness testimony that matters here is Guy Wallace's. And we know Scott Watson went back to his boat. By his own explanation, I rode a water taxi back. So the only water taxi Scott could have rode after 3:30 a.m. would be with Guy Wallace, Ben Smart, and Olivia Hope.
Now, of course, he doesn't want anyone to think that he was on that water taxi because that puts him directly in the path of all the blame for what happened to Ben and Olivia. So he's not going to say, sure, I was on that. But again, if you look at the timeline, he's lied about when he left Furneaux Lodge. He's lied about going back to his boat and coming back. He's admitted having a confrontation with Oliver Perkins, which there were multiple people there who looked at the time when this was going on. It's just really apparent that he's there on that water taxi with Guy Wallace, with Ben and Olivia. And at this point, how can you deny that he's not a great suspect here? Because he's the last one seen with them.
Now, I know that everyone's jumping out of the chair and saying, but Guy Wallace described a different person in a different boat. And when you go back to the initial interrogations, questioning of witnesses, Guy gave a similar description of Scott Watson, but said that's not him and didn't pick him out of the lineup. It's late. It's dark. Who knows if he got a good look at him? And then he gave a different description of a boat, but his initial descriptions are not this immaculate two-masted kitsch. They're like, it's a larger boat. I think it had portholes. And then the cops come back and say, that's not what you saw. Well, when you tell somebody that's not what you saw, they kind of get a little agitated. And he's like, no, that's what I saw. And the more I remember, the more I hear about everyone talking about this really immaculate boat, that's the one. Guy Wallace starts digging in into this idea of this two-masted catch. And then the cops are like, that's not what you saw. And they start having words. And then the cops go on to say, well, you know what, Guy? You were the last one to see Ben and Olivia alive. Maybe you're the one that we should be looking at. Well, you can imagine that Guy Wallace pretty much told the investigators some choice words and then asked for his lawyer, because he's now being targeted by law enforcement. And now he really doesn't like law enforcement because of the accusations. In fact, he pretty much despises them. So why is he going to work with them on his description of this mystery man and this boat? I believe that two-masted kitsch exists because too many people saw this thing. But they saw it days before and days after. There's a bunch of two-masted kitsches that are there, actually. And one person would be like, oh, I saw one. They might not have saw the same one as somebody else, but they're all seeing a two-masted sailboat. And they're all thinking it's the same one now because it had two sails on it. The only person that matters is Guy Wallace in this whole scenario. It doesn't matter if all these other witnesses got it right or got it wrong. It's only at that moment of these people on his water taxi getting dropped off. And I think Guy initially had the description of Scott right, but he got his hair wrong, or at least the artist that did the rendition got the hair wrong. And he got the boat wrong. And if you can accept that, that one person in this whole scenario got it wrong initially, well, then you turn everything on its head. And instead of making all these excuses for Scott, things start fitting into place.
Yeah, and that's really what this is about. You can have two different puzzles that you're trying to finish. You have the picture in your mind of how it's supposed to look, and you take all the available evidence and you start fitting them together. The puzzle that's going to be much more complete, that looks right, is the one where you fit in all the pieces that there was no mystery man. It was Scott Watson the entire time.
Yeah, he's somehow in all the same places as this mystery man that people are describing. And he places himself in a lot of the same places. I mean, this isn't like Satan and Santa Claus, who you never see together. They both have beards. They both wear red and black. This is a mystery man and Scott Watson are in the same places all the time during this night.
You know what would be really interesting, Justin, is if we could interview Guy Wallace and just straight up ask him some questions to see what he makes of all this. I mean, could the police have influenced his reaction, his statements? We already know that the police were pretty combative. And anybody, as you've described before, anybody who is told, oh, you got it wrong, you get defensive. I mean, it's a normal reaction. What could we say? I mean, if we could get a hold of Guy Wallace, what do you think he would say now?
Well, he gave an interview just this year where he said, yeah, it was probably Scott Watson on my boat that night. In fact, I'm pretty sure of it now. I got it wrong. So our primary witness in this entire case, who is the backbone for the advocates for Scott Watson, without Guy Wallace's story, this whole thing falls apart. And Guy Wallace is now saying, I think I got it wrong. And I think that probably was him. And if he made it back to his boat that night, I was the only one operating at that time in the morning. And the description I gave is pretty close to Scott Watson. I think that's the nail in the coffin right there myself.
Yeah, or some people won't even need that. Because honestly, if you have Scott Watson saying, no, I left about 2 a.m., I was gone, I was back at my boat, Blade, then there's no way I could have done this. And yet, by his own admission, he had a confrontation with Oliver Perkins, and there were many witnesses there at this main bar at Furnal Lodge, then he's wrong. Are we going to say that Oliver Perkins and all these other people got it wrong? No. No, they know. They talked with Scott Watson there, and this was well after 3 a.m. They know what time they left. This puts Scott Watson leaving that mainland area to head back to his boat after 3:30. And again, going through, looking at which water taxis were operating and who was operating them, we only have two drivers, and now we have one of them saying, yeah, I didn't carry anyone with that description. And then the other one saying, well, we had a guy with that sort of like that. I mean, come on. Scott Watson is on that water taxi with Ben and Olivia. He's saying, you can get on my boat. You can stay there. That's the last person seen with them. And they're never seen again. So at that point, I think you either have to say that Ben and Olivia disappeared on their own. And this guy who never admitted that he was with them.
Never admitted that they got on his boat.
Yeah. What do you have left? That's murder. We're going to have to look at it like that because they're never seen again. They're gone. And if it was an accident, how do they have an accident on someone's boat and that person never comes forward? And again, we're breaking this down to a certain time in the morning with one taxi driver. I don't see how you can get any more exact than that.
I joked before we started that we could have this whole case said and over with in 5 minutes, but the advocacy for Scott Watson, the people that truly believe that this is a wrongful conviction, their narratives have metastasized out there, and there are problems with the case. There are problems with the investigation. There are problems with the way the police were questioning and dictating the narrative. So the only way to do the story justice is to go through it all. And I'm sure other podcasts will probably do multi-part series on this. And you can go down so many rabbit holes, but we had to go through at least the problems to do that justice and to show why this is still being discussed. But then at the end of the day, and at the end of the podcast, it's that simple fact of the matter that there was only really one taxi operating and Scott had to be on it with Ben and Olivia. So it's sort of done at that point. I'm sure people can argue. I'm sure people can say, guy is wrong. He didn't see what he saw. But that's the same thing the police were telling him too. So I wouldn't reach out to that guy and tell him he's wrong because he already told the police where to go when they did that.
So this is a big deal in New Zealand. And I think the more people outside of New Zealand read up on it, it will be a big deal to them. I think one thing that shouldn't be lost in all this is despite us having broken the case down and explained how Scott Watson was likely the man seen with Ben Smart and Olivia Hope, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that when shortcuts are taken or witnesses are badgered or berated, that we should forget about that. We should never forget about that. If there's an investigation and there are things that are being done that shouldn't be done, then we should call investigators out on it. We should call prosecutors out on things too. Just because you don't like the way the investigation was handled does not mean that you have to resort to saying that Scott Watson didn't do it. You can have it both ways. You can hold investigators and prosecutors accountable, but if it's shown that someone likely committed a crime, let's not lose sight of that, because at the end of this case, we're still left with Olivia Hope and Ben Smart, who were never seen or heard from again and were likely murdered.
Thank you.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid.
Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.